Coming at you live from the precursor to Oblivion Machinimas, it's Cartoon Night in Canada.
Hey, what you watching?
Got a problem with cartoon?
Yet another episode of Cartoon Night in Canada, a nostalgic podcast where we dig through the animated past to find what cartoons made here in Canada are worth remembering. I'm your co-host, Chris O'Santonio.
And I'm your co-host, Sylvie Kettles.
And I apologize for my voice and lack of energy. I am coming off of a two-week sickness that has been plaguing my life.
Chris is dying, guys.
It's true. It's true. Faster than usual. But I'm sorry if the energy's not here, but I am very, very excited to talk about this week's show because we're returning to a favorite subject of ours. Those early, awkward growing pains of CGI animation.
Somebody's gotta do it.
It's just a window of time when everything was janky and that was perfectly acceptable.
Yeah, the jank was just... That was just what it looked like. Like, we didn't... This was a time, like, pre... like Pixar CGI. We didn't know that it would eventually look and move incredibly. This was just what CGI animation looked like.
It was before those idealistic times when photorealism was the end goal, and we had nothing to compare this new technology to. I mean, you have like the use of CGI animation in film and television has been going strong since like the actual 50s, when I think the first usage of it was for Alfred Hitchcock's Vertigo.
Oh yeah,
if I'm remembering my history right, my animated history. And there have been plenty examples of it growing and
evolving.
Thank you. Still got a lot of brain fog because of the illness. Apologies. But evolving and becoming more sophisticated. But there was just this one period between like the early 90s and the late 2000s when we kind of hit a plateau of what CGI animation could be and what was acceptable. And I love this period so much.
Yeah, it's like... It's a period of reboot. It's a period of, like, video games starting to test out the waters of full 3D models and fully walkable worlds. Early Thief games.
Yeah, yeah. It's everyone just, as we said with reboot, like, putting the tracks down as you are moving forward with this technology. And having nothing else in the field to compare it against... You were just inventing the wheel every time you started a new project with this technology. And because of that, it's so easy to just write it all off as poorly aged. But when that's what both myself and you really admire about this time is that it's so of a time. It's so of a... The limitations of this technology are the really fascinating point.
Yeah, like this is... It's so cool to look back at old, like, early CGI... television and be like, this is, people were figuring it out, and this is how we got to where we are now.
It's why we were so kind. Well, there's a reason why we're so kind to Reboot, because Reboot is great, but also a lot kinder to say something like Donkey Kong Country, which previous episode of the show, which
it's a hideous hot mess,
but it's the, like, it's a company, Nelvana, experimenting with CGI animation for the first time, and it's fascinating. Like, just that jankiness, that hot mess aspect is so interesting to return to.
Yeah, especially when it's, like, a pre-established animation company like Nelvana, where, like, so all of your animators, your in-house animators, are all trained in traditional 2D animation, and so it's a lot of the old guard testing out a new technology combined with new artists being brought in who understand this technology better. And it's like everyone's trying to work together to figure out how are we going to make this new thing, this newfangled thing work?
Yeah, it's like these established animation companies, like, seeing the winds of change in their industry, possibly accurately estimating that, say, by today, by 2024, it's going to be the dominant form, or almost like the exclusive form, of all animation on television and in film. Like, get with the times or be left behind.
Yep. And so you gotta make some jank.
So somebody somewhere has got to break the mold and has got to really be the innovator in the field. And thank you, Reboot, for doing that. But also, there's stuff like today's show. This week on the program, we are booting up our PlayStation 2s and not skipping a single cutscene because we are taking a look at Excalibur. Spelled with an X, of course, because we are in the hip millennium.
Yeah, X's are cool.
They were. God. Not since what happened to Twitter.
God, no, I'm just... That does make me think. I wonder if Elon Musk saw Excalibur and was like, he is still living in 2001.
Yeah, that's kind of his whole vibe. I'm assuming that he did not see the show, because I don't think anybody has seen the show.
Well, I know of at least 3 people who have seen this show.
I know about 5 Redditors who fondly remember this on R Nostalgia, so there you go. That's a community. The show was created by Amélie Aubert, Benjamin Legrand, and, right the hell out of nowhere, legendary visual artist Philippe Droulet. You have absolutely seen this person's work before. Famous visual artist and comic book artist who is kind of in the same camp as the same artist who contributed to stuff like Heavy Metal Magazine and other anthology comic book series and magazines. What's he doing here with this CGI sword and sorcery show? Well, hey, everybody just needs to experiment in the 2000s, right?
Yeah, honestly, that kind of feels like what it is that he was interested in expanding into CGI, and this show was being created, and he was just like, hey, let me in. Put me in, coach.
He was already... Exactly. He was already working a lot with, like, computer-generated images for his own visual art, and it's just like, hey, here's an opportunity to experiment in the medium of television. It doesn't really contain much of his signature artistic traits, but hey, what can you do? The technology was limited, as we'll get into when we talk about the look of this show. The show was produced by Paris-based studio Ellipse Anime, who had a long working relationship with Nirvana, of all people, producing shows like Babar and Rupert, future episodes.
God, are they ever.
We'll get to them, don't worry. Montreal Broadcasting Company, Group TVA, and Montreal-based animation studio Tooncan Animation, probably best known for their work on Sylvain Chomet's Triplets of Belleville.
Oh, hello! Hell yeah!
Sylvain Chomet's Triplets of Belleville. They did some of the animation work on that, and have a bunch of exclusively French cartoons that only aired in Quebec that I have no information on, so...
We might try to get to them, but it'll be hard since neither of us speak French.
Yeah, I don't know the intricacies of a show called Rotten Ralph. I'm very intrigued by it, but I'm assuming that has never... Yeah, how? Like, I'm so... Like, why is this character so rotten? But it's not... I don't believe it's dubbed anywhere, so that's going to be a bit of a curveball.
We will do our best.
We will...
That's a later problem.
that's a later problem. We will always strive to do our best, and we'll see. The show premiered on September 1st, 2001 on YTV, because, you know, if they're willing to take a chance on Reboot, they will take any and all CGI animation in the early growing pain years. It lasted 40 episodes and finished its run on April 1st, 2002. For the podcast today, not knowing where to start with this epic tale of sword and sorcery and elegant tapestry of, like, rendered models and pixels, we picked the opening chapter of this computer fable and watched episode 1, The Sword of Justice, directed by Didier Porcel and written by series creators Amélie Aubert and Benjamin Legrand. Original air date, as I said, September 1st, 2001. Excalibur.
Sword of Justice, if you were in Canada, if you were in France, it was L'Épée de Justice. Or if you were in the Occitan region of France, Espasa Justicia.
Justicia? Yeah, just, I don't know. It's a language I never knew existed until we started talking about this show. That's a fun little thing to bring up right away.
Yeah.
This has been dubbed into a very obscure, not obscure, but like, little spoken language in a French region to the south.
I have to imagine that it's because it's, like, one of the animation... No, because the French animation studio was in Paris, so I have no idea why specifically it's originally dubbed in English and French, which makes sense, that's where it was created, and then also the Occitan region of France. So it's dubbed into Occitan right off the bat.
I don't know. This is the first and probably only time that we're going to come across a show that is dubbed into Occitan.
Yep.
So there you go. That's a fun little trivia note for this series.
Yeah, it was just something that came up very early on when we were working on it, and then I went down like a mini rabbit hole of looking at this language. I didn't find out a whole lot. But it is just an interesting language in that it's... You can see the connections that it has to other Romance languages, where, like, it's definitely French, but it also has a little bit of that Spanish stank on it.
That Spanish stank.
Yeah.
That's your description of the Occitan language.
from someone who knows very little about linguistics.
Yeah, it's French with some Spanish stank. Got it.
Yep.
Apologies to our Occitan listeners that do not exist. So this was your pick.
Yes.
In your efforts to diversify the shows that we cover, you have gone on little internet expeditions to find things that neither of us have heard about.
Yeah, I spend a lot of time on, like, some YTV and Teletoon, like, Reddit boards, basically.
So out of character.
Right. It's because it's the kind of place where people are going to bring up an obscure little show that they watched once when they were 7 years old and have never heard anyone speak about since, and this was one of those cases. Someone was like, hey, does anyone remember Excalibur? And everyone, most of the people commenting were like, I've never seen this in my life. There were maybe two other people going, holy shit, yeah, Excalibur, I watch this all the time.
And correct me if I'm wrong, you had no idea this existed.
Absolutely no idea.
I also had no idea that this existed, and I was a bit disappointed, because I thought I was more or less knowledgeable on my obscure attempts at CGI animation in the awkward growing pains of the 2000s.
Yeah. But
this is a complete curveball to me. Never heard of it before. Didn't even realize that it was a YTV original.
Yeah, like... It's so under-remembered. Can I go ahead with that?
Yeah, why not?
Like, it's very interesting, too, because I think it's not only just a very early foray into CGI animation, it's also a very early foray into telling long-form narratives for children. Like, we often... consider, like, people always talk about, like, Avatar the Last Airbender as being a first, huge quote-unquote, for, like, telling a serious adventure fantasy story for children where it's like, no, you have to watch every week or you're going to miss something. And here's this little show from 5 years earlier doing the damn thing, and just no one remembers it.
Understandably, they don't remember it, because I think as soon as this finished up its run, it was banished from the airwaves and never really made it to syndication.
Oh yeah, I definitely did not rerun.
Like, and that's just the pitfall of long-form television storytelling, is that it's kind of hard for that to live in syndication when every new episode unveils more of the narrative. But you're not wrong. Like, this is a very ambitious project, not only with its use of a still developing technology, following the path that Reboot carved out for it, mm-hmm. but also in building this sword and sorcery epic plot around an actual 40 chapter story. This is
a very ambitious show. What's the word? Like, just crippled by the limitations of the technology. Like, it's yes. very clear, even in this first episode, through like the design and the writing, that like they want to do something very grand and epic with this story, but they physically can't.
Yeah, they are hampered by the limitations of the technology, as well as most likely a networked a television network that isn't willing to take it as seriously when it's not going to be as popular as the other programs that are using traditional animation, which is what people wanted at the time. Mm-hmm. And as well as it's a commitment for an audience to stay with this epic saga for the 40 or so planned episodes. And I can understand why it had an impact on a very small amount of people who are willing to give it that confidence to stick through it. But also, it's so off-putting at the time. Like, 2001, here is not only a long-form commitment of a story, but in a style that is so alien to you at the time.
Yeah, and that's one of the things I think why like Reboot was so wildly successful, is that sort of even the jankiest of early CGI lends itself very well to an out of this world sci-fi kind of experience, whereas this is taking all of the hardest sells. Like, it's this unnatural CGI animation, this brand new animation, but we're doing a gritty, realistic sword and sorcery fantasy, which this is Fellowship of the Ring wasn't out yet, completely changing the landscape of the fantasy in film and television. Like, fantasy was still kind of a hard sell for the new millennium.
Yeah, outside of shit with, like, outside of soft fantasy within, like, that bubble of the Disney Renaissance.
Exactly.
You weren't going to be able to sell this to many people, because a lot of previous efforts, like fantasy films, like that 90s Dungeons & Dragons movie, it's like, they don't work. Nobody, like, they die at the box office. It wasn't until the token fantasy of the Lord of the Rings films that people were willing to give it a shot, and then theaters were just flooded for a bit with that stuff, like Chronicles of Narnia, Aragorn.
God, even, like, in terms of Dungeons and Dragons, 3.5 edition wasn't even out yet. That was 2003. So, like, the most popular version of D&D before 5th edition wasn't out yet. So D&D was still, like, in this weird limbo space of being such a niche hobby, a micro niche hobby.
Yeah, it wasn't as mainstream as it is today. And so something like Excalibur, as you said, it was going to be a hard sell on top of a hard sell.
Yeah, but they were fighting uphill both ways.
Just real quick, because I feel like the actual look of the show is going to be the meat of this conversation. Let's talk a bit about what the show is about. I wrote out a little explainer here,
sure,
as best as I could. So It takes place in a kingdom, shook up by the scheming of a regent, who aligns with an evil sorcerer with an unpronounceable name to assassinate the line of succession and it's take Quoden. Over. It's what?
It's Quoden.
Quoden?
Quoden.
Quote who?
Quoth the raven, nevermore.
Got it. The newly crowned king is only 10 years of age. The Monastery of Magic monks has been genocided, and nothing is standing in the way of this kingdom falling into chaos. Except a pair of plucky protagonists, a feisty princess and a radical monk, carry the two MacGuffins which hold the future of this nameless kingdom in the balance, a Book of Life and Excalibur the Sword, and are the only thing that stands in the way of evil taking over. Did I get everything?
Yeah, that sounds about right. There's also a dragon.
There's also a Mushu, yes. Yeah. There is a wise-talking comedic relief dragon. Have you ever played Oblivion, Might and Magic, Kingdoms of Alamar?
I've played a lot of Oblivion.
This is an archetypal sword and sorcery plot. You have absolutely encountered this within the pages of a fantasy book and or a fantasy video game.
I mean, even the title itself and the loose... Like, this is loosely based on Arthurian legend. That
loosely
very,
based.
Very loosely. Like, the name of the sword, the fact that it's in a lake at one point, and the name of the to-be-king is, like, Arthur. It's not his name is not Arthur. That's very important.
Could not afford the copyrights.
Arthas.
The Arthurian legend.
His name is Arthas.
Yeah. Like, you can see the setup here. It's, this pilot, I will say... does a lot.
Oh,
it's
yeah.
Very impressive how much of the plot it gets across and still able to feel it's not bogged down by exposition.
Yeah, there were definitely like a few points where I felt like, oh, this is going to be the finish of the setup, and then we're going to have to, like, the next episode is going to have more setup that I'll need, and then I'll look at the runtime, like, oh no, we still got, like, 10 minutes left, and then, like, we show up at the monastery, and it's like, oh, okay, this is going to be the, oh no, we're getting the full introduction of our second protagonist, okay.
We have to get these two protagonists to meet, we have to get their sacred objects in their possession, and we have to get the evil, dark sorcerer, Quoden, to threaten them with his flying castle before we are set off to unite the land and save this nameless kingdom.
Yeah, like, it's an interesting setup, too, like, because right off the bat, I was kind of worried that Arthas was going to be, like, the child tag-along, but no, he is still in the castle... presumably under the thumb of Bragan, the regent, and fully believes
the one who
him.
Assassinated the king. Yes.
Yeah, like the guy who just murked his dad. He's like, what? No, this is my new dad, I guess.
It's so cliche to this genre of like, oh yes, the advisor to the king who doesn't look evil at all.
No, definitely. He is bonus points. He's the brother of the king. So he would have been next in line before Arthas was born. Assassinating a child is so much easier than assassinating an adult.
You know from experience, yeah, but, yeah. Like, Prince Bragan, he had no idea of knowing. Maybe he just had a pang of humanity in him. It's like, killing a kid, that's a little far.
Because we don't get a lot of interactions between Bragan and Arthas in this episode, but maybe that is a thing moving forward, that he's, like, he has some affection for the boy.
Probably not. This guy has absolutely no affection for anybody. He quite literally sold his soul to the devil.
Yes. I mean... not valuing your own soul is very different from whether or not you value the life of your nephew.
You're willing to kill your own brother. Eh.
Yeah, but you know how siblings are.
Sometimes. I mean, like, there's never been a succession-type plot of, like, well, they stand in the way of the throne that you want, like, so... yeah, might as well organize a hunting party and have them assassinated.
Oh, shucks.
Yeah, this pilot is honestly pretty efficient. Like, if you can get past the look of the show, there's enough intrigue here, narrative-wise, to hook you in and introduce these characters and put enough speculation in front of them where it's like, yeah, this could be interesting. Like, at the end of this 22-minute episode, the our band of three, that being Princess Janna, Herrick, and the Flying Dragon Whip, are, like, essentially branded as criminals by this kingdom, by Prince Bragan, and are now on the run to both clear their names and thwart Quoden's efforts to take over the kingdom.
That's a solid setup.
It does a lot. It's really impressive how much plot that you get in this episode and just how naturally it all comes out.
Not to rehash old ground, but once again, the Dragon Prince, get better.
Oh yeah, I forgot about that show.
Yeah, like, it's kind of amazing how much better a fantasy pilot can be if you know where you need to focus.
What this pilot speaks to me, which the Dragon Prince did not, is that the actual story arc of the show was meticulously planned out from, like, day one.
Yeah, it feels very much like we know exactly how much time, we have very limited time, we need to set things up and get the story going.
And I think that also just, again, has to do with the fact that we are working with highly unpredictable and new technology, and God knows where the landscape is going to shift, like the animation industry landscape is going to shift in the next couple of months, which this show is coming out. So we need to make sure that at least for this guaranteed 40 episodes that we have contracted, we know what we're doing.
Mm-hmm.
I'm just going to assume that, like, there's, like, next to no filler in these 40 episodes.
I would, yeah, without having seen anything beyond this pilot, I'm inclined to agree with you that, like, this is very much, they knew exactly how much time they had, they knew that odds of them getting renewed or for another season or a spinoff were extremely low, and they were like, nope, we're just gonna do the damn thing.
Because God knows how much these episodes costed at the time.
Oh, I imagine wildly expensive.
Yeah, we are dealing with the just released, not necessarily just released, but improved technology of Wavefront Maya,
mm-hmm.
now known as, like, Autodesk Maya, was just being made, like, available, like, to wider audiences. I think its original release was, like, 1998.
Wow.
Yeah, so 3 years after this release, there is an entire, like, there is an entire television show that is completely reliant on this technology to produce. And, yeah, because am I right? Was Maya originally, like, designed for that Disney film Dinosaurs?
I don't think so, because Dinosaurs was, like, 2000.
Okay, maybe I'm thinking how it's actually phrase is that the widespread use of the technology within that movie kind of opened the door to other studios, like, all across Hollywood to really embrace it.
Oh yes, Disney was involved. They collaborated during its early development.
There you go. And yeah, like, not to, it's an unfair comparison to say, like, the Walt Disney feature animation company with Dinosaur and Excalibur. It's not a fair comparison at all.
Mm-mm. Oh, they requested that the user interface of the application be customizable to allow for personalized workflow.
God, remember when Disney gave a shit about users and personalized experiences and...
No, I don't.
Customize and, like, yeah, what a time.
That is a very useful thing for, like, an animation software to be able to do, is to be personal, like... So each animator who's got a completely different style and workflow can futz around with the system to make it work for them.
Yeah, take notes, Adobe.
Crazy.
So yeah, like, I think this what this plot has to do, it does it very, very well. I, even though it is a bit cliched in a lot of its narrative aspects, it's all just classic sword and sorcery kind of plot points, and it's embracing them completely without any irony or
wink to the audience. Yet.
No, not in 2001. It was only in, like, 2004 yeah. is when irony became a thing.
Yes.
We all know this.
Fuck. No. Irony did exist. It was invented by Alanis Morissette in 1996.
Well, there you go. We had both been corrected.
I just had to Google when ironic came out real quick.
Ah, I see. Okay, I got the joke now. Now I got the joke.
Thank you.
The brain fog. It's really affecting my sharpness here. I will say that with even though I'm a huge admirer of this show and what it's accomplishing with its pilot, I feel it's also heavily beholden to the trends of the time. Not even though we've just mentioned that, like, yeah, fantasy wasn't in right now, but you know what was in? Comic sidekicks.
Yeah, like you make the Mushu joke, but yeah, I would not be surprised if there was heavy inspiration.
Yeah, like that you needed a small animal sidekick for the two protagonists. You needed one of the protagonists to have spiky hair in a blonde.
Oh, he's really got frosted tips. Frosted tips. And a spunky girl character.
Spunky girl character who is legitimately wearing Willem Dafoe's Green Goblin outfit.
No, I'm pretty sure she's wearing Oblivion horse armor.
There you go. One or the other. This is like I think that's the one aspect where Philippe Drouet's fondness of color comes through. It's just in her armor.
Yeah. Because you know what? It works. Just give her some green skin-tight armor. Fuck it.
That looks very plastic because,
well,
hey,
everything,
2001.
Yeah, everything in this show looks plastic.
Everything looks plastic.
Except for the stuff that looks like rock.
Which also kind of looks plasticky, honestly.
I'd say it looks less like plastic and more like the crafting foam.
Crafting foam, okay, yeah. So you got plastic armors, muddy textures, crafting foam for all of the natural landscapes. Oh, wow. We are firmly in 2001 with this technology. God, you know what? Yeah.
I know, like, Oblivion came out 5 years after this show. They look so similar. Like, this, the texture of, like, Janna's dad statue, because, yeah, one of the good guys turns into a statue at the beginning, and so that's part of her quest, is that she's trying to save her dad from being in a statue. It's the exact same texture as, like, the statues of the, Daedric princes in Oblivion.
Kind of, yeah. I mean, like, just take one of these character models and put them in one of the cities in Oblivion and see if anybody would blink if you shared that screenshot around.
I just need, like, a shot of, like, Herrick. Like, when Janna walks up to, like, meets him in the first place, I just needed, like, the screen to lock in on him and zoom in a little bit.
You could feel it. You could absolutely feel it happening. It's amazing just how much that video game Oblivion has completely colored my impression of all fantasy. Like,
yeah.
All of, like, sword and sorcery fantasy.
Honestly, the fact that Oblivion looks like a TV show that came out 5 years earlier, I think that speaks more to Bethesda.
Yeah, I don't know if that's a compliment or not.
I think it's a comp...
I think it's a compliment to Excalibur, maybe?
Yeah, insult to Oblivion.
Yeah,
Oblivion
something like that.
Oblivion is a perfect game, but it's ugly as fuck.
Yeah, that's part of its charm.
Yeah.
Like, it didn't need to look better because it ticked off every other box for the gamers.
The other connection is that they use the same sound effects library.
That is true. I think it all came with the same CGI animation program.
I wouldn't be surprised. But, like,
they all pulled from the same library.
Again, because I've played too much Oblivion, so a lot of the sound effects are just embedded in my mind. There's, like, one of the wraiths that Janna has to fight when she goes to get Excalibur underwater it makes the exact same growl as the ghosts in Oblivion. And, like, there's some of the same horse sound effects. There's some stone grinding when doors open. It's just like, yep, that's... I've heard this before.
Oh, and speaking of heard this before, we'll get into it when we talk a bit about the cast. There's not a lot to talk about there. Mm-hmm. But these sound like video game voice actors from the early 2000s.
They really do.
It feels like they are putting on a lot of emphasis where it doesn't necessarily go in an actual sentence.
Part of that is that a lot of our cast is English.
Yeah.
And they're really trying to hide that.
Yeah, this is a issue of the dubbing, I guess.
Yeah. Where it's again they didn't want everyone to sound British, even though like for a fantasy setting that would have been fine. Because that's what Western fantasy loves to do, is just make everyone English. That's the fantasy voice.
Maybe the Occident dub sounds great.
Maybe.
We don't know.
Can't find it.
Did you actually look for it?
No.
I didn't either. Maybe it's on YouTube. By the way, this entire show is available on YouTube, both in HD and in what's known as low quality. So, take your pick. I think you will be surprised which one you respond to more.
Yeah, the only known mention of this dub on the internet is on the trivia page on TV Tropes. It is unclear if it actually exists.
That's... okay. All you Lost Media investigators, here's something for you.
Yeah, find me the Occident dub of Excalibur.
Go. I expect a report on my desk by Monday. So yeah, it's a very traditional plot, not much to talk about, but it's a great setup for what is a long-term commitment series. Let's just get into it. The look of this show.
Oh, why on earth do it look like that?
My first note here is, oh no, and then my next one is, oh boy, and then, I want to put this into context, like we usually do with CGI animation, because if we have not been very clear on this point, the advancements of this technology would become like dramatic between like within the next few years. Mm-hmm. Like you are going from this is a new technology nobody really knows what to do with to it is the industry standard in the course of like 5 years. So 2001. Reboot had just finished its run. The Jimmy Neutron film was released. Final Fantasy Spirits Within came out. The Silent Hill 2 trailer was released. Monsters, Inc. pushed the quality of rendered fur. And then within a couple of years, you're getting stuff like Polar Express and The Incredibles.
Yeah. And Finding Nemo the year before that.
And the year before that. So it's... there's a lot of milestones with this technology happening one after the other. Like, this is something that is being embraced and tweaked and optimized within this really short amount of time that's becoming accessible to a lot of developers and producers. And so Excalibur kind of gets lost in the shuffle. It's coming right after, like, the first CGI animated show for television reboot, and before it became like all like full length, like before like the first full length CGI film for film. Like, it's a weird little footnote in the history of CGI animation. You can't really come down too hard on it because it's still a very young technology that people are figuring out as they go along, but even so, this looks
muddy
of its time.
Yeah, there's we talked a bit about like the lighting being so dark in a lot of places because like facial expression animation is a lot harder to do, so they hide it in the shadows wherever they can.
There's like no facial expression, there's like no trace of emotion on these characters. Yeah. It's like we weren't there where we could rig a face to actually emote naturally.
Yeah, so like that's a little rough. There's, like, render problems, so, like, everything is... all the backgrounds are fairly minimally done.
Oh, I wrote down here, there is no setting here. This is, like, the same planet that the Maximals and Predacons crashed down on in Transformers Beast Wars.
With, like, a few sparse trees. Like, they throw in a location, and then it has no surrounding area. My very first note was, I have questions about the practicality of this castle design. Where are the outbuildings? Where is food storage?
That, I can absolutely guarantee that was Philippe's contribution. He loves Gothic architecture.
Yeah, just, but the fact that, like, it's, the castle is, and this is a problem in, like, a lot of animation, is just, like, the castle is just, like, this standalone structure, where it's, like, this is so impractical for a siege. There's no, like, outlying farmland. Who's feeding the people in this castle?
You're saying that the historical inaccuracy is what really sunk this show.
Oh, absolutely. That was what lost its audience.
A lot of medieval studies nerds got their hands on this show and it's like, well, this is just inaccurate. What were they thinking? Jesus Christ, guys.
But, I mean, I feel like that has more to do with, like, the rendering problems of... You only really need the castle for the story, so mm-hmm. You don't need to have, like, a surrounding city, even. Like, people don't live in this kingdom, apparently. It's just, like, a castle and a monastery.
Oh, it's very sparse. Even that monastery, at most, there are three other monks that get turned into skeletons by the griffins.
Oh, God, that might be my favorite bit of animation, is, like, the monk getting fireballed and, like... You can see the moment they switch from, like, the monk model to the skeleton model.
This was a time where we absolutely had a bunch of plugins on Maya for particle effects. So,
yeah. So we're going to play around evil, with them.
Evil skeleton gas, as well as fireballs and wizard spells.
And,
man,
and
we're
going to
throw them anywhere we can. Yeah,
big old swarm of birds.
It's interesting. Like, it's genuinely, like, visually, it visually places it in a point in time of this technology, and I'm very, very, very kind to it, even though I very much enjoy the jankiness of it. Like,
I'm... This show is a mess, never change.
We're placing it into its context, where this was, I mean, not really, because we had better CGI animation on a lot of television and film at the time.
I will
but
say...
for what it is, yes.
I think it looks better than Dinosaur.
I have not seen Dinosaur in a dog's age, so I can't really join you in that hot take.
I cannot look at Dinosaur without smelling burnt rubber.
Very plasticky. Yes. I will agree on that front. Not that Excalibur is any less plastic.
No, but... It doesn't make me... I'm telling you, I physically smell rubber when I look at Dinosaur, and this doesn't do that to me, so...
I think Dinosaur just triggers a stroke.
It might!
They should, like, put a health and safety warning on that DVD box. That's...
Yeah.
That's unfortunate. Yeah. And also, more to the point with the actual animation of movement, it kind of jumps back and forth between really smooth and... jerky and awkward. Like, there's that one fight scene between the prince and Bragon, which is really well done.
It's very well choreographed. I think there's, like, this hilarious shot. I think it comes down to a very common problem with early CGI, where there's a problem of weight to your models. Like, it's hard to make the
Always.
Model feel
yep.
like it there is physical weight to it. So there's this shot of the prince, like, jumping off of this platform in the throne room, and he just kind of, like, hovers down and, like, spins his arms a couple of times to balance himself before pulling out the sword.
It's an oblivion jump.
It cracks me up.
It's an oblivion it jump. Is. Someone hit the space bar and he just, like, floated over and...
Yeah. They hit spacebar and they had a high acrobatics skill.
Exactly. But yeah, like that fight scene itself, very smooth, possibly too smooth because it feels like there's no weight to anything. But any other scene, say of just like dialogue or close-ups on faces, it has this tendency, and I think it's just because of how the technology is like worked with. Every character model has to be constantly moving when they are talking, so it just becomes really jerky and awkward.
Yeah, it's
and stiff.
It drifts into that uncanny valley because like people don't always move like that when they're talking, but the model always needs to be moving, or else it'll look too stiff.
Yeah, like we'll lose the interest of the audience if it's just a computer model with one aspect of it moving, which is the mouth. But like, no, we need to have this model constantly like just shifting in place, and it looks so awkward.
Yeah, again, growing pains of the medium. Like it's you can really see them trying.
Yeah, you can really see them trying in a lot of aspects, because like I think the character models are as good as they can be for the time.
For sure.
Don't like some of the design work on them. Like, I really... this like, okay, what's his name? Elric? Eric?
Which?
Herrick.
Herrick.
Yes.
Eric with an H. One of
Herrick, yes. Eric with an H. This main character is like Pizza Pop, Saturday morning, cereal commercial, gel tip, frosted tips. Like, as soon as I saw that, it's like, okay, not for me. I will never finish the show.
Yeah, I don't think I'm gonna finish the show either. But I would not fault anyone for being intrigued.
I would poke around an episode here or there, because much like my admiration for Reboot and how the animation improved dramatically between like the first episode of the first season and one of the episodes from the later season, I want to see if like they got better with future episodes.
That's fair. Oh, the other thing that like it's a bit cheesy, but I'm kind of fond of it, is the switcheroo they did with our protagonists of having the girl character be the warrior and the guy be the mage.
Oh, I didn't think about that.
Because like magic in a lot of these shows is considered like it's treated as something daintier.
Yeah, because you're fighting without a sword.
Yeah, whereas like you need muscles to wield a sword. So magic is for girls, and swordplay is for boys, and they just did a little switcheroo.
And also one more note about this.
Yeah.
Technology at the time. One thing I was genuinely impressed with. There are a lot of reflective textures.
Yeah.
Like from that initial scene where the dying king bequeaths the sword to the prince.
Entrusts.
You can absolutely entrust one or the other. I'm a former English major. I should know these things, but you can absolutely see a reflection in that sword, and that's really impressive for the time.
Yeah, there is a lot of skill and effort on display here. There's definitely a lot of people trying things and being hamstrung by the limitations of the technology, but there's a lot of work goes into all these shots and people like trying clever things, and sometimes it works.
It's why we are always so kind for it, because, like, again, once you compare it to somebody, like, once you compare it to the state of CGI tech animation at the time, literally nothing.
Mm-hmm.
It's made all the more impressive by that. Like, yeah, they were just making it up as they went along, trying things out, and inadvertently changing the industry forever.
Bravo to them.
Anything to say about this cast?
Well, we kind of touched on it. There are a lot of English actors trying not to sound English. So, uh-huh. So the performances are very stilted.
You've got the curse of what's his fucking name? Brain, please do not fail me. Whoever plays Doctor Strange?
Oh,
Benedict Cumberbatch.
Yeah, that's the one.
Like, how do we mask that English accent? Oh, just flatten it.
Hard. Just speak with the flattest affect and really harden your R's.
Yeah, then there you go. Now you're
an American now.
Full-blooded American.
Yeah.
Congratulations. Anyway.
So, as Princess Jana, we've got Joanna Ruiz. She's in Peppa Pig, very importantly. So she's doing fine. She plays George Pig in Peppa Pig. I don't know who that is.
Oh, it's George. You know George.
That's George, right. But yes, she's got a long-standing career in children's animation, and so this kind of feels like an attempt to step out of that boundary. She's also done some work in the Final Fantasy animation sphere.
There you go.
So, yeah, she does baby shows for babies and sword and sorcery.
Kind of, sort of, yeah. I did not like her performance.
It's, again, it's that the restrictiveness of trying to hide an accent, and then on top of that, she's kind of playing a snot-nosed brat. I don't like either of our protagonists, I'm gonna say it.
Yeah, I don't know if it's a compliment or not, but everybody sounds like they are doing voice acting for an early 2000s RPG game.
Yeah.
And I know we all look fondly on that because it's just a point in time when that voice acting was acceptable, but
God, one of my favorite video game voice acting, because it's not great, is the first Divinity Original Sin, because every single NPC sounds like a put upon dungeon master struggling to do a voice. And I don't think that was intentional, but that's the vibe it gives.
And that's how you become charming.
Yeah.
Excalibur does not become charming.
Sadly, no. As the other protagonist that I don't like, Herrick, we've got Ben Small. Yeah, also British, also done work in children's animation, also in Thomas the Tank Engine.
Well, there you go. That's something to hang your hat on.
Yeah, that's what you put at the top of your resume.
Yeah, you don't ever mention Excalibur and this nasally radical voice you do for it.
Nope. God.
Oh, my. Okay, I just a little glance at his IMDb. He is in every Thomas and Friends and Tank Engine thing. Yeah, oh, my God.
He's Toby.
As well as Thomas in the UK.
Oh, well, there we go.
Wow,
you put that at the top of your CV.
Holy shit, he has, built houses off of that Tank Engine.
Yeah, he's doing fine.
Sorry, we didn't like your performance in Excalibur.
As both Quodan and the Dragon Whip, we've got Tom Clark Hill, who is American. So this is our one big American boy.
I liked his performance as Quodan. Fuck off with Whip.
I mean, yeah. The problem is Whip itself. We were never going to like the performance because we were never going to like the character.
It's a really bad spice to introduce to your semi-serious sword and sorcery show. I mean, a lot of people die in this episode.
Yeah. One man gets shot, a bunch of monks get fireballed, and one man gets turned into stone in front of his daughter.
As well as the monks that get turned into skeletons. Just straight from human being to skeleton.
Did I not mention them?
No.
I said they got fireballed.
It wasn't with, fire, though. It was, with the skeleton gas.
Okay.
They sprayed him with skeleton gas, and you become a skeleton. You're right. It's there's a lot of death in this show. Again, it's taking itself pretty seriously. And then you just introduce Mushu.
Oh my god, he was in Chop Socky Chooks.
A lot of early 2000 CGI work.
Yep.
Pays the bills.
I mean, again, he's in video games. He's
set. Got the voice for it.
He really does, yeah. He's got that big, dramatic, evil man voice. And ride it. And the last one that's important for this episode is as our conniving regent, Prince Bragan, is Tom Eastwood.
I think he makes it out the best.
Yeah.
I feel like he understands the silliness of this project and runs with it. He is so over the top.
Yeah, and that's for that kind of the evil, conniving regent character, this character who is existed for time immemorium. Just the snake in the king's ear, in this case, the snake in the child's ear. Like, yeah, he is an asshole, and he sounds like an asshole. You nailed it, Tom.
Yeah, just for the people who thought that Jafar was too subtle.
I would say it's more like a scar.
Okay, yeah, same basic premise. Yeah. Like, this is, like, again, this story, it's not exactly original.
Yeah, and that's fine.
Fine.
Because, again, yeah, like, have to be. The novelty is in the medium. So it's mm-hmm. very much yes. like a, we're going to tell a story that everybody is familiar with, and we're going to tell it using this new technology, and hope it works. And sadly, it didn't. But,
no, I mean, it's very off-putting. Yeah, they forgot to factor that in.
But the eight people who remember this show remember it very fondly.
Good for you guys. Yeah. I'm glad that you have your YouTube channel where all you can watch this whenever you want in glorious HD.
And if you've never heard of it, I don't know, check it out. It's definitely worth a look.
I think that's what a lot of people have done, because I really was curious about this. So the episode one of Excalibur, The Sword of Justice in HD, uploaded to YouTube only 7 months ago, by the way.
Wow.
Yeah, this is a recent discovery. 3,000 views. Episode two, 800.
Yes, that sounds about right.
Episode 25, 90.
Yeah, that sounds about right.
This is definitely just a curiosity people wanted to maybe revisit.
Yeah, people have, like, hazy, half-remembered glimpses of this show, going, what the fuck was that? And then they see it and they go, oh, okay.
Got it.
Yep, that's what it was.
Actually, kind of, because the first episode, 3,000 views, and then, like, the second most watched episode is, like, the last one with 290.
Also makes sense. Just...
It's like, yep.
Okay, I've seen how it begins. It. How does it end? Okay, I'm out.
Yeah, and I guess we will also be out. Any parting shots at Excalibur?
Oh, who knows? I might get bored enough to keep going. See what happens. There's another main character that doesn't get introduced this episode.
Oh, I'm sure that will be the fix.
Yeah, that'll be show desperately. She'll be the glue that really holds the show together.
Yeah, I guess my parting shot is, like, it's absolutely of its time, and God bless it for it.
Yeah.
You're not, like, looking up this show to complain about the poor animation or the jankiness of it, because it's literally the best that this company could do with the funds that it was given at the time.
They did their best, and sometimes that's mm-hmm. all that we can hope for, especially when we're trying things out.
And I think you really nailed it when you said, like, you can definitely tell the passion behind this project. Like,
it would have to be. It would have to come from a point of passion, because this is a shitload of work to put into something you don't care about.
Yeah, that's the... I feel like that's the conclusion on most early CGI projects. It's like they're using a really cumbersome at the time technology and have absolutely no guarantee that it will find an audience. Nobody was ready for these plastic models who really carry a show, and regardless, you just threw yourself into it and created Excalibur.
Yeah, I'm glad they did.
It's like why even if I don't like the movie, I can't come down too hard on stop motion animation.
What movie?
Dependent. Like, if I don't like the movie that's using stop motion, it's like I really don't like, for example, Isle of Dogs by Wes Anderson. But damn, that puppet fur is very pretty.
Yeah, that's fair.
So there you go. That is Excalibur. Check it out if you want. It is all available on YouTube, and you can join the other eight people on Reddit who remember this.
There can be nine people.
We're so close to the literally dozens of us. There are literally dozens of us Excalibur rememberers. So that will do it for yet another episode of Cartoon Night in Canada. Thank you so much for checking us out. If you like what you heard, and how could you not, please consider giving us a like, share, review, and subscribe on your podcatcher of choice, preferably Apple Podcasts, because it helps us reach the widest possible audience. You can find the show on Twitter, not X or Excalibur, at Cartoon Night Pod, where we post new episodes sort of every Saturday, but sometimes not.
Yeah, we're a little late on the jump this week.
If you could not tell throughout this episode, my voice is slowly losing its luster, and I have been sucking back Halls this entire time, so there you go. You can find myself on Twitter at CinemaCreep, where I will join my brethren at our nostalgia and fondly remember Excalibur as a show that existed.
And you can find me at Sylvie Skeletons, where, I didn't think of a bit.
Goodbye, everybody.
Goodbye.
That'll do.